Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Never apologize, never explain. It's a maxim attributed to many politicians over the years, but not one we abide by on Politics on the Couch. So first, here's an apology. Sorry there hasn't been a podcast episode for a while. Thanks to everyone who's been asking. It's reassuring to know the audience is still there, and kind of embarrassing that we don't serve it as often as we'd like. And then the explanation. Or flimsy excuse, actually. Phil and I have been a bit busy doing other stuff, as you'll hear in this bonus bit of Couch Chat. Yes, what you're about to hear is a conversation between me, I'm Raphael Baer, if that wasn't clear already, and Phil Berman, producer of Politics on the Couch, recorded at the start of a meeting we had to talk about, well, Politics on the Couch. It had been a while. We had some catching up to do, and on the off chance that us catching up about the general state of politics and what's on our minds might contain something useful for podcasting purposes, we hit the record button. Now, we're well aware that there is no shortage of podcasts containing two blokes babbling on about politics. Really no shortage at all. A veritable glut, in fact. But as Phil pointed out, we were definitely two blokes babbling on about politics in a podcast before it went commercial. So think of this as one of those bootleg recordings of an indie band in a room above a pub, and not one of your stadium rock big name podcasts. Great though those are, good luck to them. Anyway, we chatted about Phil's Twitter fast, the changing mood in Westminster as Tories start to give up hope, the paradox that elections can be essential structures of democracy and showcases of democracy at its worst, and, speaking of things at their worst, we talked a little bit about GB News. Loads of other stuff too. At some point we stopped recording because we needed to talk about all the episodes of Politics on the Couch we're planning to do, and we wouldn't want to spoil the surprise. So think of this as dusting off the couch in anticipation of some more politics and psychology sessions in the run-up to the next election. And thanks for listening.
I've taken an almost complete break from Twitter.
Oh, really? Interesting. I should say I've noticed, but I've been a bit sporadic in my Twitter use as well. I tried Threads. I'm finding Threads not quite satisfying.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a cliche, but there's the correlation between the less time on Twitter, the happier I am.
Yeah.
And the obvious observation is how puerile and how ridiculous all the arguments and conversations tend to be when you've been off it for a while. You're like, really? Are people really arguing about that still?
Correct. Yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, it may surprise you to know that there is a deal with this in a book recently published. Okay, I don't want to mention the book. No, the, as you all know well.
49 seconds it took you to mention the book.
As I say in the book, which, and I promise that's the last time I'm going to mention the book, something that you know will almost certainly make you angry. And, you know, why would you do it? Why would I stop saying, here's this pill, Phil, take it. And what will happen is you'll feel really angry about the state of the world, angry and slightly impotent at the same time, and slightly frustrated. And you'll want to join the anger whilst also knowing that it's not going to make anything better. Why would you subject yourself to that experience voluntarily? It's amazing.
Yeah, but you keep coming back for more, don't you? Not you personally. Well, maybe you personally.
Well, I do a bit, yeah. I can't, yeah.
And obviously, present company accepted. There are a lot of big egos on there, aren't there?
Well, the interesting thing is the question that I always have to keep asking myself in relation to this, because I do, you know, I'm quite disciplined, you know, not on weekends, not getting involved in Twitter spats, but I do look at it relatively regularly when I'm in work mode. I tell myself that, unfortunately, because it is part of the mechanism that defines the narrative, I have to be a bit aware of what's going on there. And I, you know, while also trying to keep a critical distance from it. And then the question is, the two questions arise from that. One, is that even true? And second, even if it is true, are you still just polluting your judgment and your sort of cognitive appraisal of what's really important by exactly as you describe, even being aware of the most pointless, futile, childish debates that go on there? If it's big enough, you'll find out soon enough. Like, if there's an earthquake, you'll feel it. You don't need to be on Twitter to go, oh, there's an earthquake.
Okay, so I'm going to test your theory now. I've been off Twitter for, I occasionally go on there, but I've been off it for about a month to 6 weeks, okay? What's changed in British politics in that 6 weeks that I would have understood a lot better had I been on Twitter, constantly the last 6 weeks?
That's a very good question. And I'm prepared to say the answer is almost certainly nothing. The harder test would be, is there a story? Is there a news event that might be significant? It might pass you by because you didn't see it on Twitter. So, you know, I presume you know that Rishi Sunak slightly reneges on climate goals, for example.
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, yeah, you're aware of that,
I
right?
I knew okay. that, but it doesn't surprise me.
And but whereas you might not be aware that a one opinion poll has shown that Rishi Sunak's popularity rating is ever so slightly up. But that's exactly something you don't need to know.
And isn't there someone who always says, never look at one in isolation?
Yeah. Okay, so I've got another one. Have you seen, here's an interesting one, because this is very insane. So if we do end up sending this conversation out to our listeners, this might be sometime in the past, because who knows how long it'll take to edit this. But have you seen the clip of Lawrence Fox being absolutely vile on GB News in a way that has led to him actually being suspended from the broadcaster?
Okay, I'm going to make an admission here, because it's a classic one, isn't it? Where people say they've been off Twitter. But I did have a look yesterday to see what I was missing, and so many people were talking about that clip that I felt compelled to see how bad was it.
But you did find that from Twitter. I mean, obviously, others will have alerted you to that, but the salience of that is a very Twitter event in the way I curate news. I mean, obviously it matters a lot more than other things, but it felt to me in the way it was integrated into the news cycle, the flavor of it as a news event was very Twitter.
But it didn't change my opinion of Lawrence Fox. It didn't change my opinion of GB News. Are we allowed to say that GB News is a bit of a cesspool?
First of all, we're allowed to say it because it's self-evidently true.
And it's been, I don't know what the Ofcom rules are, but it seems to have been breaking or infringing Ofcom rules, or the rules that, normatively, the rules that Ofcom should have about news programmes for months and months and months and months.
Complaints against it on that have been upheld, but also culturally, self-evidently, it is a flagrant defiance of the principles on which the Ofcom rules are written.
And the thing that surprises me the most about that story is the final bit of it, which is that they've taken him off air. And I'm like, really? I thought he was doing the job.
And Dan Wootton as well. Now we should probably not get too into depth of this, because this is where the invisible lawyer on my shoulder goes and say no more about any of these things.
I think that if you work within political journalism, you're a news reporter, you know, these things are actually quite important because they are part of the daily news cycle. But in terms of, you know, where Britain is going to be 2 or 3 years' time, does it really make any difference?
Well, that's really interesting. And this is something that I think is where it expands beyond just the conversation about Twitter and social media, which we've talked about many times before. I think the current state and health or non-health of a very right-wing, slightly shock jockey, American-style broadcast ecosystem in the UK, thanks to Talk TV and GB News, and in a sort of feedback loop with the Mail and the Express and the Sun, which have always been there, are going to be influential in an interesting way, particularly if the Tories lose the next election. Because if you think back to sort of 1997 and the run-up to that, I mean, obviously, there are so many ways in which it's different. We know all that. But one of the interesting things is that the right-wing media basically had to sort of wake up and go, oh, we've lost the country a bit here. you know, even they got behind
Blair. In a Chris Morris again, way, like you lost the news.
Yeah, they just went, oh, maybe this country isn't the one that we've been telling it should be for the last decade, and we need to get with the program a bit, up to a point. And I'm obviously Blair and Brown courted Murdoch, so you know it's much more complicated than that. But what I mean is, the Tories after 1998 had to do eventually the sort of self-criticism and the appraisal that meant, okay, we have to modernize. The Cameron modernization impulse that, you know, first Michael Portillo flirted with a bit, that emerged over time, Theresa May saying, oh dear, we're the nasty party. I wonder whether it'll be harder for the Conservatives to do the equivalent thing, to go on the equivalent journey if they lose, because they will have this comforting bubble of a NatCon mad right wing space that allows them to carry on feeling relevant and have a much bigger ecosystem to sustain themselves in. Does that make sense?
I think it does. So what you're saying is that because of the sort of what they call the silo system of thinking that, you know, GB News is a bit of a norm, and that, you know, they can say things on there and they're part of the normal kind of discourse, rather than kind of looking to try and get mainstream media more on side, they'll perhaps won't get so involved there, and they'll be like thinking, oh, so well, we GB News still support, you know, us, a sort of right wing like us.
Yeah, and also cultivating fellow travellers and commentators, and there'll be people who can still go on telly, and you know, even if not that many people are watching, people who will still be able to exist in their parallel universe, where actually the problem was that the Tories weren't right wing enough. That sort of stuff.
Do we know how many people actually watch GB News? I've got no idea.
I saw something saying, in terms of the sort of rolling news channels, it's now well established as a rival to BBC and Sky. In terms of actual, yeah, but no one watches those things anyway. Those are the things you watch when you arrive at a hotel, and it's the only channel that's on. Right? But in terms of people actually watching actual things that people actually watch, with serious numbers, it's a minnow.
Why? So I've just Googled this, and it says 600,000 people a day. I'm shocked, honestly.
But also, then the little clips and the bits that they send out on the YouTube, that, you know, that could be a lot. I mean, this is the opposite of what I've just said, in a way. I mean, this is the interesting thing. You know, when Sunak did his slight reneguement on the climate stuff, I was having conversations with people who were quite worried that it would play a lot better than, for want of a better term, the Westminster Village and the liberal left voices on Twitter, because they're actually an awful lot of really quite net zero skeptic people out there. And it has, some of this stuff has the potential to be a bit Brexity, in the sense of where, oh, I hate all the terminology around this, but where the sort of SW1 thinks public opinion is, and how many people there might really be out there who believe stuff that's not in that part of that consensus on climate. You know, how many of them there are. You could be shocked. You know, it could be a big, smarter move than some of us want it to be.
I don't know. What the polls? How have the polls reacted to what Sunak's been saying then around climate change?
The sensible people who follow opinion polls say it's too early to say, and any movement you're seeing now, it's...
I would say, quickly, before you go into that, I always hark back to the episode we did with Karen Stenner on the authoritarian personality of the voter. And I always think that what she said rings true to me, that there's always around about a third of the population who have the propensity to worry about normative threats, i.e. that someone's coming along and they're going to take your way of life away. And so I always think that at any point that can be activated. That's why it never surprises me that whenever the Conservatives are at their sort of lowest low, they still always get about 26, 27%, don't they? You know what I mean? It doesn't sort of, I mean, notwithstanding with European elections, which could be a different matter, but what I'm saying is that there's always that kind of sense that at any point you can really scare a certain type of voter into being really worried that your culture's being taken away, your way of life's being taken away, your car's being taken away, everything's being taken away from you. You can't live life as you really want to in Britain anymore.
I think that's absolutely right. And that is the flaw to a certain vote. But also, interestingly, I mean, I had a very revealing conversation with a moderate, sensible Conservative MP not that long ago, who will, for obvious reasons, because of what I'm about to say, remain nameless. We were talking about the tension between the campaign that the Tories probably will end up having to do as a core vote strategy just to limit the damage, which is a very divisive culture war driven, exactly as you described, just try and get as many people to think lefty lawyer, Remainer, Keir Starmer, you know, with his gaggle of road blocking, Extinction Rebellion, tree hugging eco-terrorists who wouldn't know, you know, who would basically ban Top Gear if they could, are going to take away my Brexit and my, and call my daughter a son and vice versa. And I don't like it and I don't want it and I'm voting Tory, right? So that is, it's a terrible campaign in every single respect. It's a deviation from the truth and it would massively backfire, probably in the sense of handing a load of, you know, giving Michael Gove's seat to the Lib Dems and all that sort of stuff. But there is a certain, if you play that tune the right way to some people, it kind of works and it might be the only thing that they've got. And this Conservative MP was sort of wincing as I described this. And I said, look, the thing is, what that raises, the challenge that raises to people like you, I was saying, is it's not, you know, can you claw back some support? Can Rishi Sunak maybe do something that actually deprives Keir Starmer of a majority? It's, would you want to live in a country in which that works? And look this person gave me, look they gave me, was one that couldn't honestly say, yes, I'd be okay with that. The problem with the people who think we might deserve to lose on the Tory side.
Exactly, but it's so nihilistic, it's so cynical, it's so dishonest, it's just, and it's kind of, there's been lots of stuff around in the news recently about news avoiders and, you know, the super distrusters, all that kind of stuff about, and I kind of, someone who's relatively interested in current affairs and politics, I'm a bit...
Oh, now I have to mention again, Phil, you made me mention my book. I was trying not to, but this is actually, should I write my book about this? Okay, no, I'll move on. Let's forget, carry on. As you were saying, just open brackets, buy Raph's book, close brackets.
It's like, why, it goes back to what I said before. It's like, why bother to listen to all these stupid Twitter debates about, because it's all an artifice. It's all a device. That's all it is. We're being, sorry to borrow your phrase, but we're being gamed. We're just little kind of, we're little commodities in all this stupid game, really, aren't we? So that sounds very negative, but you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, that's what hyper-cynical is how I describe it in the thing, the objects containing pages that shall not be named starting with the letter B. I don't know. I think there are two things going on here, right? There are a number of things going on here. The sort of that, what they'll say, all sorts of crazy things that they feel will just try and move the dial one way or another, which is quite generic to a sort of fag end of an administration. Another, though, I think is very specific to this weird sort of economic and fiscal argument or avoidance of an argument that we're in, where you have, it's so hard to have a conversation about the very big things that you would want to fix in the country, the very big challenges, when the two main parties have sort of agreed that just promising to spend money to fix them is not available. And so, but almost by definition, you're then left with either the stuff that Sunak does, like, well, I'm going to replace the A-levels with a baccalaureate, you know, which might or might not be a good idea, but it's really not that interesting or an issue. Hire new teachers, because guess what? Money. Or you get attention, or you do the Suella Braverman stuff and you say there are loads of refugees all pretending to be gay and they shouldn't be given asylum. It's just a lie and, you know, appalling in all sorts of ways. But so that, you know, what I find demoralizing in that respect is that we are now trapped in that until there is an election. And the question is, there, from that, there follow two questions. One is, if that becomes a defining feature of a campaign, does the process of changing the government make it really even harder to govern the country? In which case, the thing that is the sort of flagship or the, like, the buttress of a democracy, which is the opportunity for peaceful regime change, also looks like the most degraded part of a democracy, because by doing it, you sort of spoil all the arguments and divide the country in ways that make it really hard to bring together again afterwards. That's why I find that this moment particularly depressing, because it's that weird, you know, it's anticipating an election that I think could be really great in terms of we get to actually change the government. And Rishi Sunak, whatever else his flaws might be, he's not going to stand in front of a garden centre in Slough and say, actually, I really won. If he loses, he's not going to do the Donald Trump thing. He will go. And so the hooray for democracy, but also, oh God, democracy pollutes itself by the mechanism that is supposed to be the good thing about it.
It's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, is what you're kind of saying, maybe?
I think you just said it substantially more efficiently than I did.
My living's not made out of writing or doing podcasts about politics. So if I was to switch off and then just...
Yet. If enough people share this podcast, that could change. Yeah, listeners,
okay.
Get the help fill out here and tell other people about our podcast.
In fact, it was a bit of a lie, actually. I've been doing another podcast about the concept of state capture, and which is a very interesting idea. I'm not sure if it's now's the right time to actually unpack it. But it is also a lot to do with those institutions. So we think of those institutions like parliamentary committees and watchdogs, and they're so boring and like, you know, is what they really do. But actually, they're the glue.
What's fascinating about that, well, many things, but it is, you know, one of the hardest questions that comes at me when I've done events, you know, around the thing that can't be named, is this, you know, that finding the boundary between an honest but quite bleak appraisal of the dysfunctionality of the institutions and the ways in which they're captured, particularly lobbying, all these things that go on that mean that actually, you know, I suppose the short way of saying what I'm trying to say is a lot of the manifestations of what's wrong with politics looks exactly the way the conspiracy theorists describe it. Like, they're just to capture the democracy really not functioning being a bit of a sham, but it's not a vast conspiracy. So that the issue is, you know, where that analysis goes wrong or becomes counterproductive is because people start finding, you know, pointing who's to blame and joining all the dots. That sense of that fine line between saying, don't despair of democracy, it's all we've got, we have to make it work, without sounding like a kind of Pollyanna-ish, hopeless optimistic, saying, actually, it's all fine. At least it's not Russia. Mm. At least it's not totally failed state in an advanced stage of civil war. And getting that balance right has I found very difficult.
I was talking to a professor on this exact topic a couple of weeks ago, and there's always the danger of where you use certain terminology to describe the way our state works, and you say, well, that's a bit like a kind of authoritarian regime. And they're like, oh, so what you're saying is, you're saying that Sunak's just as bad as Putin. Now you go, no, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that if you look at the way in which the executive works and has so much power and has very, you know, few checks and balances, you know, the way in which Johnson worked, oh God, I can't remember the name of the guy now, so many of them, the one who there was going to be a vote on him and then he said, oh, we don't need to vote to get rid of him, and then they changed it.
Oh, with the lobbying scandal, yeah.
Those are the little things which actually keep a check on power in parliament.
I'm looking up the guy's name because it's really annoying me. I've forgotten his name too.
There's been so many scandals, hasn't there?
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? The sort of concatenation of scandalous things.
And I suppose going back to the earlier point is that democracy is a organic, living, breathing being which has to be renewed every day. You know, you can't just say, oh, we live in a democracy, so everything's okay. But it actually has to be kind of reinforced and lived every day for it to actually to continue working, which is something that we kind of forget because people make it as a statement of a fact that we are living in a democracy. But certain elements of it are a bit of a veneer sometimes. So I sound like a conspiracy theorist by saying that.
No, I don't think because there is that exactly that tension between having to have a certain amount of confidence and faith that the culture of a democracy is resilient, because institutions alone can't do it.
Mm.
Stalin constitution of the 1930s guaranteed freedom of assembly, freedom of political parties and free speech, and self-evidently it didn't have it. I mean, North Korea has a constitution. So, you know, no, just saying, you know, reform the institutions, change the laws doesn't get you a vibrant democratic culture. But on the other hand, we've clearly demonstrated in this country over the last few years that a system that says if people go to the right kind of school and have the right kind of education and are generally in the term good chaps, they can be trusted to know where the parameters are and you don't have to have fixed rules. I mean, and that point, I thought it's very interesting, you know, as you say that, you know, when you say this person is behaving in a way that seems authoritarian and someone goes, oh, well, you've just, you know, compare everyone to the Third Reich, then you can't have proper argument and this, whatever the law is on the internet, the argument's lost as soon as someone's Godwin's law, thank you, and all that. And but you have to be able to tread between saying that there are styles of government and bad habits that we reject because they are analogous to the very worst things that happen, but they don't necessarily mean we're always on a slippery slope, that every, you know, that when Boris Johnson, so a classic example is Johnson proroguing a parliament, you know, the illegal proroguing, that demonstrated kind of a habit of mind and an approach to government that was, you know, kind of obviously authoritarian, because he basically said, I want to dissolve parliament because it's not going to do what I want. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you could then immediately hear the sort of the sound of jackboots on cobblestones echoing around the corner, and the whole of British democracy was about to sink into the mire. And getting that balance right, I think it is really hard to understand, like, for why it's intrinsically wrong to behave certain ways because of the health of democracy, without saying this problem that we've identified is literally a reenactment of the worst thing that happened in the 1930s. It's clearly not that, but also, you know, it's bad because of that, or that is the evidence that is relevant for why it's bad. Do you see what I mean? And I find that, I think it's very difficult they're very difficult lines to navigate.
Well, you've just reminded me, because you said that you used the term a slippery slope, and then it just reminded me that there is actually a term for that, which one of our previous guests, Meg Russell, mentioned from the Constitution Union, which is a democratic backsliding down the slippery slope. See what I did there?
I like
and,
it.
And it is a process, not an event as such. I mean, the proroguing was an event, but what I'm saying is it's a move towards a different way of government. But the other thing about democracy is everyone thinks of democracy as one singular concept, but ultimately there's so many different forms of democracy. There's so many different types, from your representative to your constitutional, etc., and different ways of doing it. So when you broadly state, oh, we are living in a democracy, it once again, it avoids those nuances around the different types and the styles and the ways of doing it, which... You know what? I was going to ask you a question about your book, and now we've gone off on a...
Let me finish the thought, because... because I think what you said about the different styles of democracy, different modes and representative and direct and all these things. And crucially, I think what additional to that is the thing that when people think, what is the most instrumental, important feature of a democracy by which you know it as democracy, is elections. But actually the rule of law is just as important, and that's the harder bit for people to grasp, I think. And so what made the prorogation thing so toxic, you know, he wasn't sort of, you know, I mean, when Donald Trump says I didn't lose the election, actually I won, and I've instructed, and always starts telling people count the votes differently so I've won, like, it's so obviously cheating. Like, everyone gets, you know, everyone who doesn't live in a kind of weird QAnon bunker gets that that's wrong and you shouldn't do that in a democracy. But, you know, when it's, for example, you know, Liz Truss as the Secretary of State for Justice and responsible basically for the judiciary, not being able to find the words to criticize a newspaper headline that accuses judges of being enemies of the people, and sort of sides with the sort of Brexit populist narrative that, well, basically judges shouldn't be beyond criticism because they are getting in the way of the will of the people. You know, that breach of essentially sort of her oath as Attorney General or having that judicial role is a terrible affront to democracy, but at a level that's already quite arcane and isn't just like, I refuse to stand down, I cheated in the election. It's, you know, and I think this is interesting when you think about the threats and the failures of democracy, actually in the US, but also in kind of Orban's Hungary and in other places. It's that rule of law thing that feels to be more vulnerable than people carry on having elections, you know, long after they've stopped really accepting that everyone is equal before the law, including, for example, the Prime Minister.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I was going to ask you a question about your book. Did we also we want to say something about where you've been? But that will be answered by my question. So you've been doing the paperback version, is that right? Yeah.
I've just been writing a new preface to the paperback.
You may have been on the air. I don't know. Have you been appearing on other rival podcasts?
Not much.
No.
I had a really hardcore. Yesterday I recorded something which will probably be out by the time anyone listens to this, which is really intense. It was a Radio 3 thing called Free Thinking. And I was with John Gray and a professor from New York, whose name I've now forgotten. And it was all about philosophy. And it was really intense.
That sounds really interesting.
It was quite interesting, but it was quite in the deep end.
Do you want to remember the name of the? Because it might sound a little bit rude if we put this out.
Yeah, no, I will. You look up the name of that bloody MP, right? Teresa Bejan, and she was in New York, but she's actually professor of political theory at the University of Oxford. And my defense for having forgotten the name is because the John Gray was very much the focus of the episode because he's got a new book about Hobbes and the new Leviathan.
John Gray, anyway, Fullstorn. Did he do a book called Fullstorn?
He's done lots of books and he's deeply pessimistic about liberalism. And we had, anyway, it was intense in terms of having to feel that I was needed to sound cogent and articulate in dispute with an actual philosopher, as opposed to just another journalist, which is what I normally do.
That's good training.
It was quite good brain training. But other than that, you asking where I've been and what I've been doing. Well, there was a summer holiday. I'm allowed to go on holiday.
With your paperback version, have you changed your mind about anything that you wrote from the first, from the hardback?
That's a good question.
That's what people say when they don't want to answer a question.
Yeah, I'm saying, well, I can tell you, Phil.
I think it'd be great.
A good
title for a podcast would be, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that, Phil.
I'm glad you asked it.
In all honesty, and that's another thing they say when they're about to tell a lie, isn't it? Oh, no, it's like, you know, honestly, mate. Okay, I'm not going to tell you a lie, but for the most part, I found it very reassuring going through it that actually there wasn't stuff I thought, oh man, you called that completely wrong. I had been very careful not to get sucked into a commentary on the most recent events. So, you know, a lot of it is, you know, analysis going back to the 90s and the roots of, you know, how we got into the mess we're in and earlier. And so I wasn't that vulnerable to, you know, terrible, hideous, embarrassing refutation by events.
You didn't put anything about Liz Truss would make a fantastic prime minister.
Mercifully not. And this sounds tremendously arrogant and immodest, or at least, I hope it's not.
I wonder what you're going to say now. You're the best political writer ever existed.
You might very well say that. I feel like I'm supposed to comment. No. How's me plugging my book turning into me sounding like an absolute tit? No.
You said this is going to sound arrogant. I was trying to think of the most arrogant thing you could say.
Okay. I'm better at football.
Better than average.
What was I going to say? No, I was reassured. Yeah. I was reassured going through the book that actually I thought, actually, you know what, some of this stands up all right. So there's only so much change you're allowed to make because the publisher said, don't mess with the pagination. If you start adding whole new bits, then it messes up the index, it messes up the pagination. So it really was just a question of writing a new preface going, this is the paperback. And the main thing was, is this going to be, when the paperback comes out, it's going to be facing right into an election, which is very different. And so what I actually wrote in the preface was really, and this is why it's present in my mind, that point that we were just talking about a second ago, this paradox that Elections are the emblematic mainstay of democracy, but have also become this awful showcase of the worst of democracy. And that paradox, which wasn't really in the book because it was, you know, at a top written, you know, there wasn't really an election so much in view when I was first writing it. So that's the main addition. And then other than that, there was a comma in a wrong place in a footnote. God. And that really annoyed me. And I'm very glad to be able to change that for the paperback.
I'm terrible on commas. I wish there was a masterclass I could go on with comma, even though my wife is a teacher's
commas.
she doesn't teach commas. She teaches teachers.
Okay.
Who teaches the teachers? Well, she does. Emeritus
professor of comma studies, University of Punctuation.
Well, they Grammarly should have got hold of that. But question for you: this is something I've wondered about for a while. I should have Googled it or asked ChatGPT.
Is this going to be another opportunity for me to say that I write better than Ronaldo takes free kicks or something?
Well, how did I get that? Ronaldo takes free kicks. Is that a book? Is that right? No.
Sorry. It's just words just came out of my mouth.
So your hardback came out in May. I just knocked my glass. And the paperback comes out in... When's it come out?
Good question. Well, one for my publisher. It's a spring. Okay. Ideally before the election. I'd encourage you to listen to this publishers. Let's get this one out quite soon. If we can.
Okay, there's two.
It'll be in the spring, sort of April, May.
Oh, that's okay. All right, okay. But there's sort of two or three questions rolled into one. Why don't books go straight to paperback? In a good way. I don't mean that as a negative. Not like straight to Netflix rather than go to cinema. And why do they do both versions of them? Why don't they just say, well, we're just going to do a hardback, and then they could reduce the price of the hardback in a year's time, or bring up the price of a paperback and just only ever have a paperback? What's the economics? What's the psychology of having a hardback and a paperback? It just seems very sort of old-fashioned.
It's a good question, and it's one of many, many features of the publishing industry that I have discovered having written a book. It's just weird. I don't really understand or want to interrogate too much. I mean, yeah, it's, as far as I can tell... Mm. It is publishing convention as much as anything else. Okay. I'll happily be corrected on that. You know, and in theory, if no one buys the hardback, publisher will go, well, let's not bother doing the paperback. I'm flattered that enough people bought the hardback that publisher have said, excellent, good, now we will do the paperback. That's in itself a hurdle cleared. Mm. But why they don't just go straight to paperback, it seems to me to be, I think, a matter of that's the way the industry's always worked, because generally not that many people buy hardback books.
What else? We're supposed to be having a conversation.
Yeah, we're supposed to have a conversation. Maybe we should... Oh, can I just... One, before we end this little segment, which I think we should send out as an episode, because I think it would be quite entertaining. But with a caveat, have you been following very important discussion about the obnoxious volume of bro-style two blokes jabbering podcasts, which we have just done? And so the only reservation I would have about putting this episode out, or this conversation we've just had out as a podcast, would be... Is it a terrible cliche that here we are, two middle-aged centrist dads yabbering on the understanding that there is a mood abroad that there's far too many podcasts that sound like that? Ours is unique, obviously, in many ways, but there are too many of those.
Can I push back on that on a few reasons? Okay, so I think there are too many blokey podcasts giving out advice. So ours is not really one of those kind of self-helpy type podcasts.
Although you won't regret buying my book, by the way. That's advice.
50% of this podcast is not being about promotional publicity. So, you know, in that sense, it's not necessarily like all the other Bray ones. And also, we started just before the explosion, I would say.
Yep.
So we're allowed to, we started in...
We were early adopters of the two blokes wittering on genre.
Back in March, April 2020. I think if we just started and this was our first podcast, we're not going to name names, but we did get a bit of a dodgy review, didn't we, once? Because we did exactly this for a podcast.
Oh, you're right. Yes, that's true.
Oh, God.
For being a bit casual, a bit unprofessional. Whereas, in fact, we were pioneering the podcast idiom, I think is what's actually going on there.
Yeah. Plus, putting my all right hat on for a moment, I should never forget.
You even own that hat?
I do. I know the voice. I sometimes do it in a kind of jokey way with people, friends, and they don't always get it. I go, like, I'm never going to apologize for being a bloke, okay? You know? I'll say what's on my mind. It's a free country. I'll say whatever I think, you know? Because my opinion is as valid as anyone else's opinion, type of shtick, if that's right. So Anyway, let's just put out that clip
of what you just said there, that one line, and put that out, and just to make sure that no one listens to our podcast ever again.
I'm a bloke. I can say whatever I want.
And Owen Paterson, speaking of blokes with strong opinions, he's the guy. And the reason it's taken me so long to find that is partly because I got distracted and I was trying to have a conversation with you. But also, if you Google, lobbying scandal, Boris Johnson, Parliament, Brexit, you get so many things that he did. And there are too many returns to the scandal. The only way to find the Owen Paterson specific one is to know his name, to search for it. But eventually, because I knew that he was a former Northern Ireland secretary, I put that into the search and then it comes up straight away. So Owen Paterson was the guy we were looking for earlier.
Good. And I forgot his name. I failed on that one because I was supposed to be searching for that. The reason Raph and I were meeting up today to discuss a new series idea for Politicians on the Couch, which we've absolutely failed to do. And I think it'd be way too meta to
especially because we've got previous on saying we're going to do things and putting them out on air and then not honoring our promises. We are.
So we should probably stop this podcast.
Hit the pause button. And then let's take the rest of the conversation offline, I believe. Actually, just one last thought.
One final thing.
You know, so much of the political analysis and commentary is now predicated on the idea that they will lose. And I defer to all the data scientists who say, look, no one comes back from where they've been to. Mm. You know, it could get close. You know, Keir Starmer could somehow fall short of majority. But basically, Starmer's going to be barring the most extraordinary accident, Starmer's going to be the next prime minister. But if somehow we reach February 2025, and beyond the last point,
It could
go to January 2024.
No, you really despair.
It'll be next year sometime. But if we get to 2025 and somehow we've still got Conservative government, it will be very hard to have confidence in the capacity of British politics to renew itself through democratic means. I'm not saying I would then go and like set fire to stuff and become an extra parliamentary radical, but I am. What optimism and confidence I have still invested in the political system of this country rests quite strongly now on the belief that there will be peaceful regime change next year. And if there's not, I honestly don't know what I'll do apart from definitely. And then the preface to the third edition of the book would be very, very different.
Oh, you've made me feel down now.
Oh, sorry. But it won't be fine. Of course, the Tories are going to lose.
Tell me that everything's going to be all right.
They know, do you know what? I'll tell you one thing. Something that's changed that you won't get on Twitter and that I didn't only really appreciate from going back into Parliament for the first time in quite a long time is that body language has completely changed now. And that's since summer. And Tory MPs will say, they've said it to me, that they just sort of know now that they've lost. And the Labour people, they start to say when, not if, now a bit more. And actually said to someone in Keir Starmer's team, it's like, you realise your people are saying when, not if. And this person said, right, we've got to stop them doing that. They're not allowed to do that. But that feeling that everyone sort of knows now is quite strong, palpable in the way that it wasn't at the beginning of the summer.
Yeah. You just reminded me of something. You know that famous Kinnock rally in Sheffield?
Well, all right.
I was at that rally.
No way.
I was studying in Sheffield at the time. I was doing a journalism course. And this is before the days of Twitter and Facebook, funnily enough.
So you don't have a tweet to say like, oh, he's blown it there.
No, because I was doing the NCTJ journalism course in Sheffield, and it was like part of the course. It's like, oh, well, it wasn't part of it, but everyone was interested in politics. And so as a group, we went down to the rally. I think, was it somewhere near Meadow Hall or somewhere? Anyway, and it was great. It was fun. It was brilliant. And amongst my friends, colleagues who were on the course, no sense at all about this being like, oh, this is awful. He's blown it. It was like, yeah, it's a great event. Fun, brilliant, wonderful, everything. And then this whole notion afterwards that he somehow blew it because of that. I've always found that really weird. And I don't know.
It's also not true. I mean, obviously, you know, it's one of those things that got retrofitted onto the narrative of, oh dear, the hubris, and all people saw that and winced. And like, I think, as I understand it, the sort of polling autopsy that showed that there were just a lot of more shy Tories than anyone had counted properly and all that was way, way more significant than Neil Kinnock sounding a bit pompous. In Sheffield one day.
It had a fun, uplifting, like a concert feel to it.
Thought things could only get better.
It was 5 years too soon, though.
Oh, yeah, 5 years too soon, I know.
Yeah, so anyway. Right, I'm going to press stop now.
Yeah, press stop.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.